There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the More Than Just Code Podcast. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lippis Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And I'm also joined by Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California.
Hello.
And do I normally say what episode this is? I guess I do, right?
You do.
Okay, this is episode 350 for those of you playing along at home. All right, or driving at home, I should say, right? Anyway, so some quick fact check. We're here obviously to talk about the Apple event that just happened today as we record, September 7th. But before we get into that, some fact check from our last couple of episodes. I had mentioned something about the session on layout was composed custom layouts in SwiftUI from the WWDC session 2022. And we were discussing the developer app and you and I, Mark, were trying to puzzle away what the check mark meant in the developer app. And I thought it was because you had bookmarked it, but no, the check mark indicates you have actually watched that session and it's remembered it based on your, because you can do it across multiple devices and it syncs to iCloud or something like that. But that's what the check mark means. And I had mentioned that Friday Night Baseball wasn't working for me in Toronto, but within a day or so of our last recording, I noticed that, in fact, I am now able to watch Friday Night Baseball, so they must have inked a deal or whatever they had to do with Canada, and I think it was probably around the release of 15.4 that Apple TV 15.4 that I finally was able to watch. I think I watched maybe like 5 minutes of a Blue Jay game, and then I woke up and went, what am I doing, and switched to another show. But there you go. So sports ball is happening in Canada.
Blue Jays are in the wild card hunt. They're the third out of the three teams that take the wild card.
See, this is all I hear is words. Blue Jays.
I know this because my Mariners are the second out of the three spots, so I'm really rooting against the Rays, the Jays, and the Orioles. If they can all somehow lose, I'd be very happy.
So the wild card means they have a chance of getting into the World Series? Is that what that means?
Well, so they've expanded the playoffs. So the top three division leaders, one for each of the divisions within a league. And we're like, you know, a bazillion games behind the Astros. We're never going to catch up. So we're really rooting to get back into the playoffs since basically that like 2001 season for Ichiro Suzuki, who came back for his like retirement and Mariners Hall of Fame ceremony within their team Hall of Fame. You know, it's been there's probably children who can legally drink now who were born after the last time the Mariners were in the playoffs. So this is very exciting for me. The bad news Bears are finding a way.
That's good for the conveners of the stadium where they play, I guess. All right. And the last thing I have on the fact check here was, this is from episode 344. We were talking about controlling, I think, a universal control. Is it still in beta? I don't know. But I accidentally one day managed to control, you can, I think we were talking about controlling the Mac from the iPad. And in fact, you can do that because occasionally, I turned it off recently, but occasionally while I was working on my iPad, I accidentally moved the cursor over to the iPad. And then I was able to control, use the trackpad on the iPad on the Magic Keyboard to control the cursor on the Mac screens. So that's kind of cool. Alrighty, and do we have any Ask MTJC? Does anybody remember what that's for?
I didn't see any.
All right.
Add your questions, folks. The only way you get the answers.
All right. So a couple of follow-up items here. One is we were talking about the Apple self-repair program. We've been talking about that for years. And the new announcement, this is probably like 2 weeks old now, I guess, August 22nd. That the repair program is now extended to M1 MacBooks as well. So you can get parts and tools to repair your own M1 MacBook models if you want. And I think I think the tools are not, you know, super cheap, but the fact that, you know, Apple is allowing us to get the bits and pieces we need to fix our own computers is a step forward, right?
Yeah, it's the sort of thing where I'm going to say it's a very Apple-y way, but I also think it's a very justifiable way. Like, these are professional level tools that they're giving you. They're not giving you a kit you're going to find at Walmart, and they're charging a pretty penny, at least for like a rental fee.
It's an investment. Yeah,
I mean, you could buy it, but you can also like rent it. You know, it kind of like back in the old days when you would rent a video game system, like a Super Nintendo or Nintendo 64 or PlayStation from Blockbuster, back when those existed, you would put down like a couple $100 and then they would return most of that minus the like actual $10 to $20 fee. It was basically just, you know, to make sure that you weren't going to abscond with the device, or if you damaged it in some way, that they would be able to recoup their costs. It's the same thing for this.
Or if you wanted to keep it, you paid the full price, right? I mean, yeah. The other thing too about that is the parts that, and this goes back to the way it worked with, I mean, most Apple service centers would tell you this, that, you know, if you buy like a logic board or something as a replacement and you return the logic board to Apple, they credit you back some funds as well, right? So that's always been sort of a, you know, the parts don't end up laying around in a back of a warehouse somewhere. They all go back to Apple at some point. So that's part of this whole repair program process as well, is that you return the defective part. I guess so they can, if they need to, they can go and dig into it or whatever. Or recycle the gold and platinum and what have you, right? Which is good.
Yeah, critically, they're not giving us those robots that take apart the iPhones. Like,
yeah,
make those part of the program, yeah. Cowards, open them up.
Yeah, I think they only have one of those, one robot. I don't think about a ton of them, right? And anyway.
For your right? Down payment of like $10 million, they'll let you have one, you know.
And when you return it, they'll give you back all of that less $50, right? Yeah, the other follow-up item I have here is we talked about xCloud Cloud. I guess ever since WWDC, was that when they announced this? Or was that from the year
that
before?
That was a year ago.
Yeah, and for a while there, nobody was really sure what it was. And we were all sort of guessing it was sort of a buddy build kind of thing. But now if you want to try out xCloud Cloud, I think... for a low number of, I think it's 24 hours or something like that. So 24 is a number that rings a bell with me. It's free until the end of 2023. So if you're a small shop and you want, or indie developer or solo developer, and you want to, you know, kick the tires on xCloud Cloud, you can until end of 2023. That's obviously going to put things like Bitrise and a few other things to challenge them a little bit in terms of being able to do that. But yeah, it's kind of cool that you can actually try out. I don't know if you guys tried out or anybody you know tried out. I know one of my developers at work tried it on his personal app, but have you guys tried it out yet?
I haven't tried it. It's definitely problematic in any kind of company, you know, production environment, because everyone's doing Android as well. You don't want to have two different build systems.
Yeah.
I mean, you do have two different build systems already, but usually they work off like a common, you know, GitLab or GitHub or Bitbucket or something like that. So yeah, and Jenkins or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, and you're using similar scripting tools to do a lot of the automation that goes into doing builds, right? So. Yeah, when I was working at the bank, we used to run the Android builds and the iOS builds would both go through the same servers, and they were like Mac minis, and I don't know, I guess they'd be using Xcode Studio or Android Studio to build, but or whatever they use on the Android side, but it was the same boxes that we were using for our Xcode stuff, right? Like Fastlane and Open Bakery and all the kinds of other, you know, Gradle, all those kind of things were running on the same boxes. Yeah.
Tim, you got it pretty close too. So if you go to developer.apple.com/xcode-cloud. I'm going to go in reverse order so it sounds better on the pricing. So 1,000 compute hours per month is $399 per month. 250 compute hours per month is $99 per month. 100 compute hours per month is $49.99 per month. And you pretty much nailed it. It is 25 compute hours per month free through the end of December 2023. And then the now, how much would you pay? $14.99 per month if you choose to subscribe to that. they've definitely given people a lot to sort of trade out. And given that that is compute hours, it kind of makes you think maybe we should slim down that app so it doesn't take 20 minutes to build. You get more of that stuff for free, right? The closer you can get to instantaneous, wait, the more what? You got. I mean, if your app takes, you know, an hour to build, it's like you got other problems, but also you're only going to get 25 goes at it. So yeah, start trimming out those CocoaPods and other third-party things you don't need anymore. Analytics packages, etc., etc.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Yeah, and are they doing the 10 months for the price of 12 thing where you pay annually, or is it billed monthly?
Doesn't say that on here. I wonder if you get something. The pricing doesn't say here. Let me give you the link. Where is that? Right here. Yeah, I'm not seeing anything about how much savings, or maybe they throw in some AirPods or something if you subscribe. I don't know. I don't see anything that says it would be cheaper if you prepaid ahead of time.
Right. Okay, cool. All right. So I want to talk about 360 iDev for a minute. I just did my talk at 360 iDev. You'll find out in the after show that I was traveling in Ireland, and so I wasn't able to attend, and I wasn't about to fly to Ireland, back to Toronto, and then jump on a plane to go to Denver. So I had pre-recorded my talk, fully intended to deliver it online and do the questions and answers live via Zoom satellite, if you will. And all that went well, but unfortunately for me, the day I was doing my talk was on the last day, which is the Wednesday, which is never really a great Wednesday afternoon is never a great time to do, because most people leave the conference early to catch planes and stuff. But John Wilker always does a recap at the end of the conference, the sort of, you know, state of the union, state of the nation kind of thing, where he, you know, lays all the cards on the table. This is what the conference costs. This is what, you know, he's been able to do for it. This is why you should buy an early bird ticket, et cetera, that kind of stuff. Right. And unfortunately, for the last, I think it was 4 or 5 years, they have pretty much been running in the red. We knew that, you know, obviously 2020, 2021 would be bad years for everybody. But, you know, when you add that to the previous years not being so great, this year was, again, a fair amount of people in person. A lot of people went to Denver. Speakers came from England, the UK, and around the United States. I'm not sure if any came from Canada, but I know a lot of people attended in person, and it sounded like they had a good time. I mean, like I watched some of the events. I don't know if you attended any of them, Jaime, but I did catch a few of the talks and things like that. Mind you, I was in Ireland, so the time difference was huge. But the gist of it is that John has announced that, unfortunately, he and his wife and his partner, Tom, are not going to be able to see their way to having a 360 iDev 2023. So it looks like this is that there won't be a conference next year, which is really unfortunate. And for us in particular, I was going to present my video. I sent it off to them already canned, and they were going to run it, and then I was going to do questions and answers. Of course, getting this news, I felt that I had to say something before my talk was played. So I joined early and sort of gave our spiel about how we personally, I think I speak for the three of us, about how 360 iDev has been important to us as developers and building community and that kind of stuff. And in fact, this podcast, you know, has its genesis at 360 iDev, because that's actually where I met Jaime back in 2012, I think, 2013. You know, the three of us attended at one point one of the earlier sessions. So it's unfortunate that 360 iDev looks like it's not doing so great. That said, John, you know, we all sort of got together on Slack and talked about how we could support them. And John has set up a GoFundMe. I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to contribute. They've surprisingly good turnout. I think, you know, he sort of set a goal, and I think they're at around 2/3 of the goal right now after like maybe 4 or 5 days, which is good news for them. But again, you know, they are conference organizers. They do an Android conference, they do an iOS conference every year, and this is how they basically make a living, right? So, we're hoping to be able to support them in that. And, hopefully you guys listeners of the show will rally around and throw a few shekels their way as well. So I don't know if you guys want to say something about 360 iDev yourselves.
Yeah, Tim, I think you're right. I think it was 2013 where we met, and then 2014 was when we decided to do the podcast.
I think before
it was. Yeah.
So it all kind of came together there. And I think it's interesting to look at this as a sort of mainstay of the iOS and Apple ecosystem world. And it feels weird to have it be the end of an era for that sort of thing. But it was always kind of like you take it for granted that just as the sun is going to rise tomorrow and the seasons are going to change, you just kind of assume that come around August in Denver, Colorado, there's going to be a 360i dev. So it's really sad to see it go. And I know that John and company put a lot of heart and soul into it. So kudos to them for keeping it together for as long as they did.
Yeah, it's really a shame. I only actually got to go once in 2014. That was the year we all went. I was supposed to go again years later, as you guys know, but I got sick the last minute, so I couldn't make it. But I always watch the videos and really enjoyed everything. It's sadly, I think it's a reflection on both the state of the iOS industry and just the economy in general. I mean, right now with a lot of companies are cutting back, so I don't think there's a lot of money being spent on travel, so that really hurts people going to these kind of things. So. Yeah, it's really a shame. Hopefully, things are cyclical. Hopefully things will swing back at some point.
Yeah. I mean, well, and speaking of the videos, they are going to be publishing the videos. Obviously, the people who had tickets are going to get the videos. I think coming up, probably by the time this podcast comes out, they'll start trickling out if John can wipe the tears from his eyes. But yeah, so that should be coming. And then, I think within a couple of months, they'll be available for anybody else to watch. So it's always a good set of talks. I mean, I got a lot of good feedback from my particular talk. So I'm looking forward to being able to see some of the talks that I missed because of the time change and things like that. And plus, being busy and flying and all that other nonsense. All right. Anyway, so pouring one out for 360i Dev. And so, yeah, we're here to talk about the Apple event. Obviously, the iPhone event went today. Did they call it Way Out, or is that just what people
were calling it? Far Out,
right. So, and because of the star constellation animation thing that they had going on here. So we can just go through the various things. Tim Cook came in and he kind of like laid the groundwork for the fact that they were going to talk about AirPods Pro and about the Apple Watch, and then they kind of dove into that. So we'll just go through the items. I hope you have notes. I know I do. And talk about the stuff. So the first up was the Apple Watch Series 8 coming out, right?
Yeah. Continues to have that always-on face. They started out with talking about the new temperature sensor for women's health, so cycle tracking with two different sensors. One that I think they said was pretty close to the skin and one that was pretty close to underneath the display to give them a little bit of what was it like checking for differencing in bias or something around how temperature works and can sample your wrist temperatures every like 5 seconds, looking for phases and shifts and different things that might trigger, belief that hormones are changing, might be ovulation, might be cycle deviations. And because of the world in which we live in 2022 in the US of A, all of that is very notably encrypted on device and is only accessible via authentication. If you sync to iCloud, it's also encrypted end to end. And they pointed out that Apple itself cannot look at that data.
Yeah. I mean, having tried to, in my first marriage, we went through this whole process. We were, taking temperatures and constantly checking things and trying to find out when was the right time to try and, create a baby. So this will be super helpful for people. Carol was also suggesting today that this might even be helpful with things like if you start getting a fever, like if you catch COVID or something like that. I'm not saying Apple said this, we were just guessing that could be something it'd be useful for. But I think it is a very tricky part, when a couple are trying to make a baby, that keeping track of ovulation is kind of interesting. And the fact that it'll does the automatic retroactive reporting, along with cycle tracking and a few other things, you can actually check it and you can like get relatively decent data about when things are happening and when the optimal times for certain activities are going to take place. Right. But that also goes along with the other stuff that the other health things that they're doing with you know, heart. They talked a lot about hearts and stuff like that, or you know, heart tracking. Or I think, and a lot of people, there's lots of stories on the internet, and one of the Slack channels I was on today, people were talking about how, you know, the Apple Watch, you know, keeping an eye on your physical being has helped people with, you know, unusual heart issues and stuff like that. One of my friends actually ended up in the emergency room because his watch told him that his heart was not, you know, operating properly. And so it's all good that they're sort of putting this health stuff way ahead of everything else, right? The other thing too is along with fall detection is this new crash detection too, which as they said in the talk, a lot of, I think they said half, I think over half or half of the car accidents that happen don't necessarily happen in the city. They may happen in a rural environment. It may be a single car involved. And I think they had a commercial a while back showing that, you know, the phone can actually call 911 or the watch can call 911 for you, right? But and this is combining the barometer and GPS's, microphones, and I guess a few crash sensors to sort of to get crash data. And apparently they have a 1 million hours of crash data that they tested to get these sensors working properly, with the motion sensors as well. That was the other part of missing. So that's kind of cool. And then, you know, they talked about the fact it was in rural areas, which raised a question in my mind, but they did cover it later on in the talk as well. But yeah, it's kind of cool that they've got the crash detection going on as well now.
Yeah, new stuff from the deep learning, machine learning analysis of sensor data, right? Like, you know, during the pandemic, they'd added the, it can tell that you're washing your hands and let you know that you need to keep going for the full 20 seconds. This crash thing is pretty cool. So it does, you know, can call emergency services, also notify your emergency contacts, very similar to the fall detection. I think this is pretty cool. I am already wincing for the, you know, TikTok challenge and YouTubers that are inevitably going to like do dumb, don't do this at home, terrible stuff, trying to, you know, there were people like trying to fall on the floor on purpose to see if the watch could detect them, you know, falling. And imagine that the internet will still say, let's see if we can make it detect crashes and see what it does, right?
And that sensor can detect up to 256 Gs. If there's an API that tells you how many Gs it's detecting, that's just opening it up to people doing stupid things, trying to get that number as high as possible.
Wow. Until they get crushed. Actually say that in the talk, or that's just something you read in the...
The 256 Gs, they did say. The API, wow. No, they didn't say anything about that.
Oh, okay, cool.
That's speculation.
I was wondering about that because I am not sure how many G's are for gravity, that is, are involved in crashes, but like 9 G's is what you do in like a jet fighter, right? And they have to train the pilots, and they wear the special suit, and they're like scrunching their body to try to keep the blood from flowing away. So 256 G's is a lot, but
remember that's continuous G's, right? If you're flying a plane accelerating really hard, you've got several seconds of that high G. When you're in a crash like that, it's going to be that high, but it happens so fast that it doesn't happen for very long. So it's just measuring a spike. It is pretty amazing that it can measure it, though, that the accelerometer can do that.
Because all those, they must have got Mythbusters to give them some data as well, eh? Actually, I guess it'd be funny, like the Mythbusters, because you see the Mythbusters using putting a watch on Buster and smashing him into a truck or something like that.
Yeah. By the way, did I tell you I went to a talk given by what's his name? Not Jamie, Adam the other Savage. Guy, Adam Savage. Savage.
Adam Savage.
Adam Savage. Yeah. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah, I saw them do one of their live show actually here in Toronto.
Oh, okay.
Pretty good.
This was just an interview. He didn't do any actual any busting. But it's so interesting to hear his stories.
Yeah. Well, they took Chris Hadfield, who's our Canadian astronaut, and they put him in like a bear suit, and they put him up against a plexiglass screen at the front of the stage, and then they blasted him with paintballs. And so you basically had the outline of his body on the plexiglass. Yeah, it was pretty interesting evening. So, yeah. And they had they brought the, you know, the exploding water tank thing. They put a water tank on the stage, on the edge of the stage, and said, don't worry, we're not going to blow up the water tank. But But yeah, and everybody within like, you know, 50 feet of the stage had to sign a disclaimer saying that, you know, even if they got like paintball smudged on them, they would not sue the two of them. But yeah, Jamie Heineman and Adam Savage are the two names of the two guys. So coming back to the event, the 18-hour battery life in the watch, which I find surprising. But low power mode now doubles up the amount of time that the watch can hold a charge. Like, so for instance, this would be 36 hours. Is that right? Yeah, 36 hours would be at full charge. But this new low power mode is also going to be available on every watch from Series 4 going forward with it running watch OS 9, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it does trade off things, right? So low power mode, just like it does on the phone, It turns off things that are not strictly necessary. Like, you're not going to have the always on display. You're not going to get automatic workout detection. You are sacrificing niceties for just stay alive a little bit longer on the juice. So that is kind of cool that they can do it when you sort of need it. Like you're out camping or something is the one where I sort of wonder about, like, is this watch going to last the full weekend that I'm out there, kind of.
Well, I don't think it would ever last a weekend for me, but yeah, when I was traveling, for instance, some days I was out for a long time without a charge and my watch would run out of juice and it was really annoying. Low power mode would have come in really handy back then. Cool. And so colors, midnight, starlight, nice that they named one after the boys, and red, I think, were the three colors it's available in, right? Plus new Nike bands, Nike Sport Loop, or of course Hermes bands as well, and fast charging. And then so $399 for the GPS version and $499 for the cellular version. And of course you can order them today, or by now, but it's already too late to order them. And so September 16th is when the Series 8 will hit the streets and people will have them in their hands.
Cell models can also do international roaming on 30 providers. I know I saw at least Verizon. I think one of the kiddos, I forget, was it Xavier? I think it was Xavier who said that he did not see any Canadian providers on there, but I'm not sure what that full list kind of looked like in terms of coverage. Like, I'm not familiar with international brands.
Yeah, I do know that when the cellular watch first came out, it was pretty much Bell was the only one that carried it, and it wasn't inexpensive to have cellular. So, and I don't know if you remember when the watch first came out, you could basically do two calls and then the watch died in terms of battery, right? But I don't know. I don't see much use in having a, I mean, unless you're out jogging or something like that, you know, and even still, I would still take my phone with me. So I'm not a huge watch cellular believer, right?
Lifestyle, which, hold that thought. We've got another watch and then a third. Oh, what's behind door number three watch to talk about? And
wait. Lifestyle. Before you get to the third watch, we'll talk about the second watch, which is the second generation of the SE, which is the watch for the kiddos, as you mentioned before, right? Interesting. Somebody commented on the fact that it has a nylon back. I think the first watches didn't have like fancy backs, like ceramic backs or whatever. They had like sort of plastic backs as well, right? But it also has the SOS fall detection, you know, the emergency SOS. Same chip as the Series 8, I found, or same features as the Series 8. I think it's the same chip, right? But you don't need a phone to work with this watch. Your parents can set it up, you know, your parents put it together. And then you can use the family setup with it as well. And that model is $249. So basically, what, $150 less than the main one, and $299 for a cellular version as well. So that's kind of cool. Now you can talk about the new watch that I'm trying not to buy, Jaime.
Yeah, the pricing is definitely one we need to talk about for this new watch. Not the Pro, not the Max, as many people had sort of guessed, is the Ultra. The Apple Watch Ultra, I believe, is the full name. Ruggedized, mm-hmm. aerospace-grade titanium, flat sapphire crystal to protect that 49-millimeter case, which is big. And in a now-how-much-did-you-pay moment, they have a new button on there, an action button that is customizable. They've got, you know, a larger digital crown with bigger grooves and what appears to be kind of a guard system, so you don't accidentally, you know, while you're climbing the rocks, smush the grooves and blast your ears with your AirPods.
Yeah. Meant to be used with gloves and things like that too, right?
Yeah, I mean, so they pretended it was that, but honestly, it's the, oh crap, I'm you know, I'm doing something, I accidentally bonked the crown, and now my AirPods are blasting full volume in my ears.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I wear my watch backwards. I did that because I don't know if you remember, but when they first came out, I used to take screenshots all the time every time I flexed my wrist, right? So I started wearing my watch backwards to stop doing that, right?
Right. Rounding things out for the hardware. They've got, you know, a second speaker, so it'll be easier to hear when it's out there in windy conditions. 3 microphones, cellular in every Ultra, battery 36 hours on a single charge, and then if you have extended battery life, which apparently is coming later this fall, you get 60 hours. It's definitely meant for, like, a lifestyle that I think I do not have. Giving some spoilers here, but, like, it answers a lot of questions around, you know, what we first thought the watch might be back when it came out, and now here we are in this edition. It's like, oh yeah, that's like a lot of stuff, right?
Well, the GPS is amazing. I think it's going after like the Garmin sort of market, right? Because Garmin sort of went from being GPS to now they have sort of watch like features with messaging and stuff like that. And a few of my colleagues at work wear Garmins. But this is like, I'm not sure what these mean, but L1 GPS and L5, there's apparently, I guess those are much more accurate than our 300 meter iPhone. Maybe you're on the street, maybe you're on the sidewalk, maybe you're across the street kind of accuracy we get now. So that's quite a bit of an improvement there, right? So I like that. I also like the backtracking. If you get lost and you can, and you're out of range, you can use backtrack to get back, which to retrace your steps to back where you were, which is kind of cool. And then the waterproofness that is certified to EN13319, which is some like heavy duty thing. Like you can basically scuba dive or light hobby scuba dive up to 40 meters or 130 feet, which is pretty deep, right? That's kind of cool. And what I like about it personally is the fact that I don't, like, I'm always worried that I'm going to crack my watch as I glance the side of it, you know, when I'm walking around and working with tools and things like that. And I like the idea of having a flat top with nothing and with the titanium around it to protect it, right? So yeah, so $799 is what I have here for the one version, and then there's one for $849. Do you know what the differences are on those two prices?
I didn't see that. I don't think they announced what that pricing difference was. Is it on the store?
Maybe it's the better battery thing you were talking about. Because I missed that part. So is it $799 US is the price for this guy, right? It's $1099 in Canada, which, again, math. But is that what you guys have for pricing that you know of?
Yeah, I know it's $799.
I'm checking it right now. Hold on. So $799 is the base price. I don't see any $899. They're all $799.
I guess I got to go shop. Okay, somebody. Maybe there's like an option that comes with it.
Yeah, somebody had mentioned on Slack, and I missed the pricing, but yeah, no, I only see $799 myself, right?
Maybe some of the bands are more expensive or something.
Or maybe they were adding AppleCare to it. I think it's $120-something for AppleCare. Maybe that's what it was. Somebody just added two numbers together. Anyway, $799. Forget what I said.
Already forgotten, Tim.
Yeah. So is this a watch you guys would consider? Or?
Not a chance.
Mark is not a watch wearer to begin with, so that's not a surprise,
right,
to me.
I have a watch. I have an Apple Watch. It sits on my desk. I just don't like to wear it that much.
What does it do? So, does it tell you the time or nothing? Or
it could tell me the time if I looked at it.
It's always on display. If I just kept it on the charger, would be a nice alarm clock.
Yeah, it's just not pointing in the right direction for me generally to look at it, but I could.
Wow. Yeah, I am a constant, not all day. I don't do sleep tracking. That is an area that I've never gotten into with my watch. But I am a every day, maybe not every day, or not all day, every day is what I'm looking for as the word. Everyday watch wearer. This is pretty close, and I think if I was looking to upgrade, I might just go ahead and go with the Ultra, get a little bit more screen visibility space, pretend that I might somehow need the 80 decibel alarm, let folks find me, and all the other cool things. The action button, surprisingly enough, is kind of a driver for, man, yeah, I put like another button here to do some stuff and be able to customize that. I don't think I'm going to upgrade to this. I'm pretty happy with my current watch.
What do you have now?
I have, oh man, is there an easy way to tell what it is? I have, I think, the most recent watch prior to this. I think
it's, you can take it off and look on the back. It tells you what the
watch is. Does it say, hold on, it's charging. Let me go grab it. I had taken it off for the night. I thought I had 7. Let me take a look.
You can also look in your on the watch app. It'll tell you, I think. On your phone, I mean.
Guess I'm going to have to look at the watch app. I have a series. I cannot tell from looking at the back of this.
I have a series 4 myself, so I mean, again, you know, I'm not a get a new watch every year kind of person, but you know, and I don't really have many complaints about the watch that I have now, right? But it's just not shiny and titanium.
You know what? I have a Series 6. Maybe,
ooh,
maybe I'm closer to needing an upgrade than I thought. But I'm still pretty happy with this one.
Yeah, I mean, like, for what it does, I mean, like, you know, you use it for Apple Pay to pay for things and notifications and workouts and stuff like that. That's pretty much what I use mine for, right?
Yeah, and
occasionally
I'm not a cellular watch person because I don't have a lifestyle of which I would be out and about without having my phone with me. I certainly have friends and family that are, you know, runners, joggers, divers, you know, all the stuff that they showed in the wonderful commercials. This would definitely fit better for them from a cellular standpoint. For me, the cellular would be like a nice to have kind of thing that I would be very grumpy to pay even, you know, $5 more for to Verizon or T-Mobile or AT&T. And it would be more for some of the other things around the, you know, orienteering, mark waypoints, the, you know, like I could jump to a pool and not feel like I'm going to ever get to the WR100 level. There's no pool I can think of that I would go to that would hit that. So it's probably something that, you know, maybe in a year or two, I might be thinking about, yeah, I'll upgrade to that year's Apple Watch Ultra.
What do you think about the bands? I mean, and obviously they got a band for scuba diving with the fluoroelastomer thingy, but they've got two different bands, they're calling the Alpine Loop. I'm not sure what the gist of that is. I guess it's for outdoor weather. And then they've got the regular sort of loop, right? Trail loop, they call it.
Yeah. The Ocean Band looks like it is meant for ninjas to carry like little throwing spikes, or if you're going camping, you need some.
Well, it's meant to fit over your neoprene suit, right? So
yeah, but what are the holes for? Like, what do those do?
But I think that the holes are how you attach it, because it kind of like, if you look at the, there's like metal studs that go into the holes, same with the
the other, yeah, it loop, does look, right? Like,
oh that. Oh, so yeah. that's how it's staying on there.
The trail loop is sort of the Velcro one like I have now, right? Like pretty similar to what I have now, where you loop it back and it's got Velcro to stick. It's like a nylon, the middle one, but I think the top one has like a metal clip that you kind of clip it in when you're out and about. I guess the idea is like if you're climbing a mountain, Jaime, you don't want to accidentally brush the loop and have it come attached from your wrist, right?
Right. So,
which is easy to do with the regular band.
Yeah, is it? Yeah.
I have the one where it's got holes, but it just kind of there's a little post sticking out, and you just stick that in one of the holes, just snaps in. Yeah, and that could easily pop up. Yep, it is pretty old.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, well, we can move on now that we know kind of sort of that we might end up with two watches in this group of three. So two out of three of us recommend possibly thinking about upgrading, right?
Well, you know, 3 out of 3 if you're into that kind of stuff. I'm just not.
Yeah. So here's a question I have for you. Now, I know both of you have trouble with Apple earbuds staying in your ears, right? Your ear orifices. Yep. Does the AirPod Pro, this upgrade, this is like, what, the second generation of the AirPod Pro or the third generation with the new H2 chip with personalized spatial audio based on, I think, something about the scan of your head determines, you know, how the spatial audio will work with these, active noise cancellations, twice as good at canceling noise as it was before. You can charge this, I think you can charge the case with key charger, so you can put it on top of a watch charger or a MagSafe charger or any kind of compatible key charger. Is the AirPods Pro something that you guys would even consider in the wildest of your dreams?
They don't stick in my ears, so no.
Wait, so which one was it though? Because they did add the extra small tip now.
Yeah.
Did you need a smaller tip? Did you need a larger tip? Because longtime listeners to the show. So I actually do have third gen AirPods that I had received for Christmas last year or the year before. But longtime listeners of the show know that I've had issues with the EarPods prior, and I had hesitated to invest at all in the AirPods life because at the time that would hurt my ears, like the physical ear hole where the, you know, the headphone stays in was just like cramping up my ear. So apparently I now have large cavernous ear holes. This is no longer an issue. And these stay in here just fine. So I've never tried the pro sizing tips in any way. These do seem interesting from a, the one thing I don't have at all on this is the touch capacitance for adjusting volume. That is something I work around by using my Apple Watch. But I would definitely like to have the noise cancellation, especially the second gen noise cancellation, because I don't have that. It's something I miss. But these are pretty borderline for me. These AirPods that I have now are pretty new. Maybe when they start losing their battery life, I might invest in the AirPods Pro. Yeah, good memory there, Tim. That like, yes, I used to have issues with that, and now as I've aged, my ear holes have gone slack apparently.
And maybe it's the forestation in your ear canals is now able to grasp
to cushion. my old man ear hair has made a cushiony of pillows.
Yeah.
For the recharge. Yeah, could be.
Now that you're plus 40, exactly. Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, I mean, again, we could talk about these if you want, but I found a pair of AirPods Pro that somebody left on a plane, and I've been trying to wake them up and, you know, let them do the find my thing to find out where they are and try and get a hold of me. But yeah, but I don't know. I don't have any, I'm always worried I'm going to lose one and then, you know, or I'm going to have it in my ear. My dog's going to bump me and it's going to fall on the sidewalk or what have you. And, that's what I worry about. I'm still using, like, I'm using the Beats, Power Beats Pro, which are Power Beats that have the little extra arm that clips over top of your ear, right? So, I don't like to have something jammed into my ear, personally. So, I wear an extra big, you know, silicone pad thing, or whatever you call those things, right? Bud. Moving on to the iPhone 14, which is the, we've talked about this, I think we talked about the rumors about this before, that the rumor was that they weren't going to upgrade the chip, and sure enough, they didn't. So here we have the iPhone 14, still 6.1 inch and 6.7 inch plus size, now has ceramic glass shield on the top to prevent cracking. Comes in midnight, again, Starlight, named after the boys, blue. I'm going to call it purple. I'm doing air quotes purple, Jaime, because I know it's not really purple, right? And red. And again, they say all-day battery life. This is the A15 processor that we had last year. They went on about the camera, about being really kind of cool. 13 trillion photos have been taken by people using iPhone devices last year. Still a 12 megapixel camera, 1.5 aperture, which is pretty low, and 49% improvement in low light situations. It now has a true depth front facing camera. I can't remember what the benefit of true depth was. Do you guys remember that? Or an autofocus on the front camera. But do you remember what the true depth marketing term, what that has to do with anything in the real world?
I thought it was focus and other things.
Is that what that is?
I forget what the true depth does. Was that not there before as part of the Face ID? Like, I'm a little confused on the marketing.
I think the true depth is a scanner, maybe the infrared scanner for Face ID.
I might be mistaking.
Oh yeah, no, this is a thing where it's projecting all the little dots.
Yeah, that's the first. Okay, that's the true depth. Okay,
it's for making that. It's for making fancy memojis, which is very important.
Right. Oh, yes, that's true. Yeah. I keep forgetting you and your memojis, Mark. Yes, I know. So that's kind of cool. And then they introduced this idea of the photonic engine, you know, which got Mr. Sulu and Jaime all excited, and which improves all cameras, apparently. And it's just there's sort of layering of all the different exposures to create these amazing dynamic images that you can do all kinds of fancy stuff with. The video is now, again, high quality, super high quality. They're saying the highest quality of mobile devices. And smooth video smoothing without using a gimbal, which is kind of interesting if you're running around making movies and stuff, right? So
wait, was that on the 14 or was that on the 14 Pro?
That was on the 14.
I have that on the 14 as well. Okay. The action mode with more overscan and correction to stay stable with smooth video without a gimbal and Dolby Vision HDR. So if you've ever seen little kids take video and run around, it makes you want to barf. This should make that less of an issue. You'll be able to enjoy whatever it was they were really excited and running after.
So, and they talked about connectivity with the 5G service and the eSIMs. I don't know that's not new. I mean, we've had eSIMs since iPhone 12 or iPhone 11, I think, maybe even iPhone 10 had eSIMs. I use eSIMs when I travel to get my data plans going when I'm in different countries. But crash detection, like they talked about on the watch, where, you know, if you get in an accident, it'll notify, you know, call 911 for you or call emergency services for you. High dynamic range GPS is a new feature in the 14 as well. And of course the emergency SOS, I'm going to throw over to Mark to talk about that one.
Mark.
Or I could talk about it.
I guess I could talk about it. Yeah. So this is kind of an interesting thing. Actually, why don't you talk about it, Tim? Because I don't know.
So what's cool? Again, I sort of alluded to this earlier when I talked about the fact that you could get into an accident in the middle of nowhere. Well, great. What if you have no cell service, right? That was the first thing that came into my mind, because I was actually in Ireland on a sand dune trying to send a picture up to some, or trying to find the map, get the map to load on my phone so I could figure out how to get off the beach that we were on, right? And of course, there was no cell signal, right? So my first thought was, oh, great, I've got a car accident, and now how do I contact, you know, emergency services? So what Apple has done is they've teamed up with satellite services to allow for emergency SOS via satellite as a new service. And basically, it will allow the phone without Wi-Fi or Bluetooth to be able to detect whether there's a satellite available. And even they've come up with an app on your phone that will show you where to point the, because you don't obviously have a satellite antenna on your phone, but it'll show you where to point the phone for the most optimal connection to the satellite. And then what they've done is, because the idea behind this is using emergency services, they've compressed the text messaging down to make it really small, so it's a really efficient amount of data that gets transferred. And they've also shortened the kind of messages that you will get available to you. Like, it'll give you a series of, like, a choice of five messages, which you can, I've been in a car accident, I've fallen, I can't get up, you know, my phone is about to die was one of the examples they thought was just funny. But you can push the questions, and it'll, you know, send this compressed message up to emergency services, and then they can respond to you. And then basically the questions coming back and forth are, rather than you having to, like, you know, with your car crashed fingers, try and type out an answer, they'll actually give you, you know, sort of a recipe card of answers that you can sort of answer back, right? Yes, I can talk. No, I can't walk. I'm stuck in the car. Whatever they may be. I'm making those up. But the idea is a more efficient way to do that. And the other thing about this is, even in emergency services where the person you're communicating with may not actually be able to send text messages, they're setting up relay services around the world to allow in between people to get the message and then verbally speak it to the emergency services that aren't using a digital technology to communicate. So they've set up this whole sort of network around emergency services for you, if you get into a situation where you can't, you know, communicate, you're out of cell range or what have you and you're in a predicament where you need assistance. One question I have, though, I don't remember. Is this something that's available to everybody? Is it available for a certain period of time?
Free, you know, for 2 years. It launches in November in the United States and Canada, is the note.
So free for 2 years. So you have 2 years worth of protection, and then what happens?
Well, I was kind of wondering, like, is it you know, kind of like the xCloud, Xcode cloud stuff, where, you know, this is starting off free for a little bit, and then after that, it's like paid service? Or is it like a, you know, as long as you keep buying an iPhone every 2 years, are you going to get a new 2 years worth of free satellite service?
Oh, I see. That would be Ted Lasso plus emergency services via satellite.
That would be interesting to know. And they didn't talk about pricing, or what I saw.
They'll probably bundle it into one of those service packages too.
Mm-hmm.
Services.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. And by the way, speaking of which, I still pay an extra $10 a month for visual voicemail. Do you guys have that? Or do you get it with your cell service?
Visual voicemail being the thing that lets you read what your voicemail is without actually listening to it?
No, visual voicemail is the service that came out on the iPhone 2G, the very first phone, right? Where instead of having a list of numbers that called you and you had to punch, you know, call the voicemail center and push 1 to play your message and push 2 to do this, it shows you the number of the person who called you. Or the name of the person who called you. That's a visual voicemail. I pay $10 a month for that service.
Really?
I'm confused about that.
Because my cell service, I'm grandfathered from way before the iPhone even existed, right? So I find it ludicrous that I have to pay for this every month, right? But anyway, just, you know, speaking of emergency services being free for 2 years, right? I have been, how long have I had an iPhone for? What, 12, 14, 15, 14 years, I guess? Yeah. And I'm still paying $10 a month like a schmuck. And I don't even use voicemail anymore.
Yeah. That's almost as bad as I pay $5 a month for this old Earthlink email that I have because I used it 20 years ago to sign up for some things that it's just not easy to change. So I pay $5 a month for it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah.
Wow. I run my mail server. So I pay $5 a month or $3 a month for my mail too, but. And everybody in my family as well, right? So, oh, well. Death by 1,000 cuts.
Yeah.
The funny one. I did see a handful of people, not saying it was prevalent, but a handful of people kind of grumbling that it was launching in the USA and Canada first. But let me help the folks in...
Emergency services?
No, the satellite connectivity, right? So it's launching starting in November in the United States and Canada.
Well, we only have satellites in the United States and Canada. Is that what you're trying to say?
I'm not sure. I mean, I would infer that, you know, they got to set up the satellite systems and everything.
They're putting a geofence around the North American continent?
They actually have a little thing that makes you point your phone at the satellite and it helps you to get that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And if they're in geosynchronous orbits, they do stay at a constant spot above the Earth.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. And even though... if you're in Spain, there's some other geosynchronous satellite up there, but it doesn't mean that Apple has access to that satellite.
Oh, I see. I always just thought the satellites just were ripping around the Earth like the
some of them space do.
Station.
Some of them do.
There are some that do that. Yeah. Yeah.
But the geosynchronous ones don't.
Okay. I was being facetious about the Canada-US thing.
Well, in this case, I think folks need to go to, you know, when you stop driving at home, you know, pull off to the side safely, go to thetruesize.com and add the United States and Canada and go drag those over to Europe and realize that both the United States and Canada are basically the size of Europe. So we have vast quantities of nothings. I didn't realize Canada was quite this big, by the way. There's some parts of Canada that, just hinterlands, right? So really the only people who should be kind of mad are like people in like Australia, where your entire, you know, country is a continent and you do have vast swaths of nothingness where you might get lost. So I think it should come to everybody, but I would start in places that aren't like, you know, the next city is like walking down to get my postal mail.
Canada is not as big as you think it is because of the Mercator projection.
No, that's what this thing is supposed to show you, right? We can like go and drag it around and it adjusts based on that. But and granted, it's a lot of weird like islands up north that I didn't realize.
Still pretty big, Kim.
Yeah, we only live along the very edge of it. Like we're kind of like sitting on the rim of Canada. Most of northern Canada is like hinterland, like he said, right?
Yeah. So people can go there.
But you know, if I were young and lived in Canada right now, I'd be buying property right on the edge of like the Hudson Bay because the way things are going, 20 years from now, it's going
to be beachfront, right?
Resort property.
That's true. Yeah, it's ridiculous. Even land that's out down east, which was relatively inexpensive, people are buying on spec now, not even seeing the properties, just spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for pieces of land that they would have got for tens, you know, back in the day, right? Yep. So we're still talking about this iPhone 14, right? $799 and then $899 for the Plus. And again, order them on Friday. And they received them by the 16th of September, for October 7th for the Plus. Obviously, a little bit longer to get that. Which leads us to a sort of sidebar here, and that is the release of iOS 16, which should be important to a lot of people out there, as well as Xcode 14. The release candidates went out today, not for iPadOS. I think we talked about iPadOS being delayed I heard it was because of Stage Manager and a few other things, but iOS 16, Watch OS 9, why isn't it 16? I don't know. I guess with TV would be as well with that. But the fact that they're available as release candidates today, I've already downloaded Xcode 14 myself. And of course, it's got the new, which we're going to talk about in a minute, the new Pro with the fancy new notch lozenge dynamic island thing. But also that iOS 16 is hitting the streets on the 12th of September. So 4 days ahead of the release of the new phones, which is kind of unusual because usually it's like within a day or so of the new phones hitting the streets, right? So that's my sidebar on software tools.
I, for one, since we talked briefly about that iOS 16 iPadOS split, I, for one, will be letting a whole bunch of other people, millions of people around the world, guinea pig what happens when your iPhone is on iOS 16 and your iPad is not, and especially around iCloud and syncing. And if everything looks okay, I probably will update by like the 14th or 15th, but I guess I'll probably.
Well, I don't know if it matters the other way around, but I've been running the beta on my iPad for months and my phone is still running 15. Right. And I've had no iCloudy kind of problems, no, you know, syncing problems, stuff like that. There are some features that are available on, and I also run on my old iPhone 10, I'm running iOS 16 as well. And there are some differences in the way mails handle and stuff like that. Like there are extra options when you're dealing with mail. But otherwise, I've not really noticed any huge differences. The home screen's different on the iPhone 16, or iOS 16, but it's not been a huge challenge for me to have different levels of OS here. I mean, just so you know.
Oh yeah, I'm just extra paranoid about that. Like they've had a long beta period for that. So I just I'm okay if my device does something weird. I've got, you know, ways to mitigate that. I cannot do anything if iCloud does something bad, where I'm more concerned.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of developers who are a little concerned about the fact that the iPad OS is not coming out at the same time. I think a lot of people who are more iPad-centric in terms of their development are a little concerned about the fact that it's dragging behind. But then again, you know, we're the same group of people who said we wanted to have a different OS on the iPad, so can we complain now? Don't think so. Because we don't know when Ventura is coming out either, right? There's been no sort of official Ventura date yet either, right?
I think that's correct.
Ventura?
I don't think they've mentioned.
Is that an RC? I didn't check. I should check that one. Do we know if Ventura is in release candidate? Let me just have a look. Quick look on the old developer site. I have to sign in like an animal. Do you want to jump into the iPhone 14 Pro? I mean, while I look this up.
Yeah. iPhone 14 Pro with no longer a notch. They have eliminated the notch. And replaced it with the dynamic island, I think, is what they're calling the new hill.
No, that's the UI. That's the UI where the black area grows.
I wasn't clear from their, like, it's just clear that they're using the dynamic island in a very interesting way with what do we call it now? It's not a notch. No notch looks like that. Is that a punch out, a lozenge, a pill? Yeah,
I got the impression that the whole thing was a dynamic island, and the dynamic part of it is the fact that it changes size and functionality depending on what you're doing. But even when it's not doing anything, I, I felt it was still the dynamic.
Okay. All right. Okay. I'll grant you that. But I mean, you know, at the end of the day, it's smoke and mirrors because the size of the notch doesn't change. It's just,
Yeah, they just played a little trick and made the background color kind of sneak around the top of the notch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it kind of looks like it's not really, you know, part of the chrome of the phone like it used to be. Mm-hmm. And I was looking very closely. So it looks to me like there is, I think I used the term earlier, an unsafe area as opposed to a safe area where as the dynamic island gets bigger and smaller, there's always this area of it that stays dark. And that's where the sensors are, of course, and the camera. So even as the thing's expanded and it starts doing things, it always left that little area untouched, which is interesting. I mean, it's a notch. It's just a redesigned notch with some stuff going on around it to make it look and feel a little bit nicer. And it is nicer. For sure, it is nicer.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a human interface guideline VP that introduced it, Alan Dye. By the way, coming back to just to follow up on the release candidates, so iOS 16 release candidate is out today. Watch OS 9 release candidate, as I said, is out today for sure. TV OS 16 release candidate's out as well. iPad OS and Mac OS are still in beta. So they're not release candidates.
They're having trouble with that. What was it called?
Stage manager.
Fancy new thing, stage manager.
Yeah. You know, to be honest with you, I went and updated my iPad to an M1, loaded up 16, turned on stage manager, used it for like 5 minutes, and then turned it off.
Really? You know,
it's just not. I mean, like I work on my iPad all the time, and I work on multiple applications at a time, and sometimes I want just that app open, even though I'm moving data back and forth, and it's just not. I mean, I think the iPad real estate isn't enough to have that kind of thing happening, and I find the split view stuff more functional than, you know, dragging back and forth between split views than no, I don't know if it's called split view.
Do you have a 12.9 inch or 11.7 inch?
I have the 11 inch Pro.
I bet you it's much better on the 12.9. When I was doing a lot of work with the iPad a year or so ago, I found it really is night and day in the way that the multitasking stuff works between the two. There's fundamentally different behaviors, actually. The way that, for example, on the 11.7, when you have a split view, when you have a three column split view, it kind of pushes off the content view off the screen when it first opens until you tap it, and then it slides the primary view off the screen and pulls that full screen. Well, it doesn't do that on the 13 inch. It's there all the time. So the 13 inch feels a lot, with 12.9 inch, whatever it is, it feels a lot more like a desktop or a laptop, really, especially when you have it in a Magic Keyboard with the trackpad. It's, you forget you're using an iPad. So
what I didn't like about Stage Manager was the way that it groups applications arbitrarily. Like, I'm sure you can move them back and forth, but then again, I'm not one of those people that uses, you know, that sort of the different desktops that you can have, where you can put your applications on one set of screens and switch over to other ones for context switching. I don't know what they call that feature, but I don't use that. I prefer to have all, like, I'm an old school Mac guy. I have all my windows on one screen and...
Yeah, just give me a really big screen and just one, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's what I do. Really big screen. I have a 19 inch or whatever this thing is. Mm-hmm. I have the LCD screen in front of me. Like, that's kind of what I use. But yeah, mm-hmm. And then I have, like, I use my other monitors for having other experiences. Like, if I want to move a meeting over to one monitor, I'll do that, or maybe have the notes on the second one. But I'm not one of these guys who likes to switch back and forth. And you know, maybe that's the audience that stage managers built for, because I'm sure there's a way to move to change the grouping of the applications, but you know, I just didn't like it. And I tried it a few times. I tried it on my Macs as well. I mean, because I do have Ventura running on one of my Macs, and I just found it wasn't a working metaphor that I enjoyed working in, so I turned it off. Right, mind you, I do like the fact that, like, you do have it is under Control Center, so if I want to right now, I can go and turn it on. It's not like I couldn't just go and quickly flip it back and on and off. I mean, maybe there's a keyboard shortcut to do that as well, but yeah, I just, didn't really like it. But anyway, getting back to the iPhone 14 Pro, yeah, so Greg Joswiak, or Jaws as they like to call him, introduced it. I did, you know, I was just checking the stats here when we were just chatting. I didn't realize that this phone has a 48 megapixel.
Yeah,
or is it,
yeah,
quad pixel sensor.
That's a lot of megapixels. Software.
48 megapixel quad pixel sensor is what my notes say, because they talked about trying to do more interesting things of how do you represent light across all of these pixels.
Right. Yes, the quad thing. Yeah.
Yeah. As long as we're in camera, the Pro RAW stuff at 48 megapixel resolution. They apparently have a 2x low light improvement over the 13 Pro. And they showed doing a telephoto that's still a full quality 12 megapixel, which is pretty bananas that you can do that.
Yeah, it's the 3x magnification, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
3x optical zoom, 16 billion transistors. Okay, 4 nanometers, Mark.
Yeah.
I thought we, a couple of years ago, we said you're really hard to get below 5 nanometers.
It's hard. It's really hard.
He didn't say it was impossible. He just said it was difficult.
Didn't say it was impossible. It just said it's really hard.
Oh, okay.
All so, right. I mean, that's four. So a nanometer is 10 angstroms. And an angstrom is roughly the diameter of a hydrogen atom, roughly, approximately. So right. this is roughly 40 atoms wide, these gates.
Wow.
That's pretty small. That's pretty small. It's pretty hard.
Hmm.
Actually, it's not clear that the, you know, they, a lot of this is marketing. It's not clear that the gate is actually that width. It's sort of an effective width, which is, you know, an effective, like they play tricks with electric fields and things like that and geometries and architectures of the transistors so that it acts as if it were a transistor that has a 4 nanometer gate if traditional scaling worked. So, you know, in the old days, yeah, it really was the number they gave was the size of the transistor gate. And you could sort of draw a straight line. You could fit a straight line as you made the gate smaller and smaller to what the electrical performance was. Now they sort of continue that straight line and say, okay, we get this electrical performance. It's equivalent to if we had actually scaled down this thing to 4 nanometers, but probably they really aren't. Not physically, at least. It's kind of marketing, but it's still really fast. It's still really powerful.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Did that answer your question, Tim?
It does. Yeah. So it's the new reality distortion field for the 2020s.
Yeah. And next year there will be 3 nanometer. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that said, they have 6-core CPUs with 2 performance cores inside this chip thing. 5-core GPUs, a display engine, ISP, which I can't remember what they said ISP was for, and of course, Jaime mentioned before, the neural engine, right?
The display engine that they mentioned there for the A16 Bionic chip that we're talking about. Display engine, I think it was related to the display photos. Engine.
Yeah, yeah. Right, right. And then
the neural engine's not new, right? They've had that for a while, haven't they?
No, yeah, it's the machine learning thing,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, 24 millimeter focal length, which is kind of cool, which is pretty short, which is good. And the quad pixel sensor, which you mentioned, 4x as much light. I wrote down 12 megapixels, which is why when I saw the 48 megapixel on the slide here, I kind of went, what? And I think, did you mention Pro RAW at 48 megapixel resolution? I
mean, yeah,
that's
yeah,
the Pro RAW image, right?
Yeah, interesting to go with. You know, we didn't talk about the always on display somehow. That it goes as low as 1 hertz.
Yeah,
like a slow blink.
So my question is this: like, you know, in a world where we're constantly trying to turn off all the lights and make sure we're not wasting carbon footprints and things like that, do we really need an always on screen?
That's a,
like, aren't we wasting I know it's like infinitesimally small amount of energy because these things are so efficient.
Do we really need a 48 megapixel camera? I know some people will say yes we do, but do we really?
Or a 49 millimeter watch on our wrist, you know?
All right.
Exactly. You could deflect bullets with that thing. Pro Video, did they say this is the only phone that shoots ProRes, or one of the only phones that shoots ProRes video? I think we need to fact check.
Oh, I missed that statement. I don't know.
Yeah. So it was near the end there. So anyway, so $999 for the Pro and $1,099 for the Pro Max. Interesting pricing, because I had heard that this phone was going to cost a lot more. And that's the same pricing as we had last year, wasn't it?
Well, let's find out. Let's go to the stores and see, did they shrinkflation this somewhere? Because it does go up to a 1 terabyte model. It looks like they're at a 6.1 and 6.7 inch screen, respectively, for the Pro and Pro Max. So let's find out if they gave you 16 gigabytes on the bottom end, knowing that nobody's going to buy that. Let's find out.
128, it says here.
Okay.
I'm a 256 guy myself.
128 is the main. Yeah.
So I can't remember if that is the same, an upgrade or a downgrade from the previous 13.
No, it's 128 and 256 were the numbers that from last year for sure.
Okay, so they kept that.
Because I have a 256 phone and I don't need it, because I mean, now I'm on iCloud, I don't use as much data, right? But here's another interesting thing too. Here's a pet peeve of mine. You guys can finance these phones with Apple Card, right?
I believe,
like, you can do monthly payments.
I believe that is the case.
Yeah, I don't see that being an option here in Canada. I mean, unless I buy it through a carrier or something like that, right? Like if I buy it through Rogers, I can pay them monthly. But right from Apple, I'd have to fork out the money directly, right?
All right, here you go. So wait, am I looking at it right? Buy with Apple Card monthly installments. Pay monthly at 0% APR. You'll get 3% daily cash back all up front. Limited cash back, including 3%.
Plus you get 3% off or something like that, or 6% off?
It looks like it's only 3%. The 6% you're thinking of was a one-time thing that I took advantage of to get my 16-inch MacBook Pro in the final Intel, as it turns out, laptop.
Of course you did, yeah. Why not?
Yeah. So, yes, it looks like you can do Apple Card with 3%. It qualifies for the highest tier of 3% cash back.
Hmm. Oh, you get 3% cash back.
Yeah, so it when you buy at Apple or particular things, like I think Uber is one of those, and I think Nike might be another. Certain, you know, qualifying vendors qualify for the highest 3% cash back on the Apple Card. If you use Apple Pay, it is 2%. Like if you do it in store, you know, Trader Joe's or something. And if you have to pull out your card like a filthy animal, then you're down to the 1%, that wonderful 1%. Titanium card. That's kind of how it works here.
So for those of you Canadians who are listening to me complain about the fact that we don't have Apple Card here, we do get the 0% APR financing from a third party called PayBright, I guess, from the Apple Store. So you can buy, looks like you can buy a phone with a 24-month term. iPad with 6 months or Mac with a 12-month term, but you can basically buy your phone for an equal number of payments at 0% financing, which is good. So yeah, we can buy them monthly, which is good.
Yeah,
and because I guess I'll be buying a phone on Friday morning. Yeah,
they did say up to $1,000 off if you trade in some other iPhone, presumably the highest ranking, good quality, excellent quality, no scratches, etc. iPhone 13 Pro Max, I would guess, but I didn't look to see what the trade-ins were.
Yeah, I'm going to do my third-party trade-in again that I did with my iPad Pro, my iPad 11-inch. I used Orchard to trade it in and got good money compared to what Apple and their third-party services offering. Cool. Yeah, so I can get I'm just looking at an iPhone 14 Pro. At $1,549 Canadian, I can pay $64.54 a month for 24 months, and this phone will be mine. So yeah, that's good. I'm glad we can do the financing here in Canada. That's great, because I'm tired of paying my cell carrier for a phone.
Looks like my iPhone 12 they're offering $430. I don't know where this $1,000 comes from, because the iPhone 13 Pro Max says up to $720. So I'm curious where this $1,000 comes from.
So you guys don't have a service like Orchard. It's run out of a bunch of U of T students here in Toronto that started it. But basically, it's a place where you can go buy used phones, right? And you basically run an app on your phone and it tells you what they'll offer you for the phone. And I usually get, because I take really good care of my phones, I usually get an extra $50 on top of what they offer, right? So yeah, I think I got like. $400 or something like that for my iPad when I traded it in. And this is the one I used for my, when I had the iPhone 6 Plus, I used the same service and I got like $350 back in the day when I went to update that or trade that one. And it's still considerably more than this company that Apple's dealing with for trade-ins is offering, right? I find the trade-ins from Apple are pretty low.
Yeah, it's like a convenience versus absolute price kind of thing. Some of these are okay. I've used Gazelle in the past. I think somebody had another one that they
I think Gazelle is similar to what we have with Orchard. Is Gazelle still around? Or
I don't know. I've gone the Apple route for a few different times just to avoid the hassle. Certainly, you could do like a Craigslist or Kijiji, eBay kind of thing if you really wanted to max it out, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. Like Orchard is kind of, they send me a box. I put the phone in the box. I send it away to them. I wait like a month and then they send me back. They tell me they sold the phone and they give me the money, right? So if you want to sell it right away, they'll give you less money. But if you want to max out the money, you just let them put it on their store and leave it there for a while, which is cool.
Yeah, kind of seems like it's on consignment in that case.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Pretty much. It's a good deal. Look, this phone's unavailable for the 2-hour delivery. Currently unavailable. So it's unavailable for pickup in the store either. Yeah, this is the part where Greg always asks us if we're going around the table. I am definitely going to get a 48 megapixel phone. So I'm going to get the 256, probably black. This deep purple, that's not purple. That's not really purple, right, Jaime?
Not in my opinion. And kudos to Xavier for having the meme pick of Wolf of Wall Street, Matthew McConaughey. Those are rookie purple numbers. You gotta get those numbers up kind of thing. I think what it said. And so I want it to feel not like it could be confused with lilac or lavender. Like that is straight up Prince or the Joker purple, right? Like purple. Be able to point to that and be like, get that punk violet out of here. This is purple, okay? Like the Kool-Aid, purple grape, purple Kool-Aid drink kind of thing. No shame to people who want it. If you like the color, great. I want purple, deep purple, full on purple.
So here's a question. So pre-ordering starts at 5 a.m. Pacific time on the 9th of September, which is a day before this podcast will go out, unless I really work hard, but really hard, Mark. But are you going to order a phone on Friday, Jaime?
I am on the edge. I think I would probably go with the 14 Pro. I don't think I need to go to the 6.7 inch Max. I would get it in silver because that is a color that I've kept for a long time. It would be the 256 gig model, which looks like it would be $1099, if I'm looking at this correctly. And that's probably what I would go with. I will not wake up at 5 in the morning to do this. I'm not. Again, I'm borderline. I'm like, I think I will get one, but maybe I'll be okay waiting for the second wave. What are we talking, October, November, maybe early December for a second wave of deliveries, depending on availability.
When you order it.
Yeah. It is a nice phone. It is an upgrade from my current 12 Pro. The thing that gives me some pause is the buying into the rumor that maybe they'll go USB-C next model.
So let's talk about that for a second. USB-C, right? I mean, I have it on my iPad. I kind of find it annoying. Although, you know, basically I leave my iPad pretty much plugged in most of the time and I have the Magic Keyboard thing. So it charges off that. So if I want to go rogue and just grab the iPad and go, but and for my phone, I use the MagSafe charger all the time, right? Except when I was traveling, I was using a Lightning port. Is it really that important to have a USB, now that we have magnetic charging, is it really important to have a USB or on your phone? Like, what's the benefit? Maybe hooking up a hard drive to it, but...
That's fair. Maybe I'm out of date in what MagSafe chargers can do. The fast charging is something I like for the Lightning cable and when you have the right adapter.
Right.
But realistically, am I using it enough to warrant not just going into a USB-C / MagSafe life? Maybe it's time to transition on that.
Okay.
I think you raise a good point.
Mark, are you getting a new phone? Okay, yeah. Of course I did. Mark, are you going to buy a
phone? So I have a 12 Pro that I'm using right now. So I am due. So I am going to buy a 14 Pro. Will I buy it on Friday morning? Probably not, also because I don't need to be the first to have it. You know, been there, done that.
I will get
one, but it's not like this one is dying right now. It can wait a couple months. So I'm not gonna, you know, get up early to get it. I don't care about USB-C at all. I do the same as you. I use MagSafe. I can't remember the last time I plugged my phone into something. So I don't care about that at all.
Yeah. And the size of the phone is bigger than the current one, right?
They seem to imply that when they were talking about the 14 and the 14 Plus, they were talking about 6.1 and 6.7, which they were saying was bigger. But I'm not even sure what the 12 Pro is anymore.
Well, we have the ultimate iPhone graphic thing somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere.
6.1 inches
from Paint Code, I think.
PhoneArena.com claims. I don't know how accurate that is.
No, it was Paint Code, I think, was the company that had the graphic. One second. Yeah. Pulling it up.
www.paintcodeapp.com. So it only goes up to 11 Pro Max.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty old.
But the size, I don't think the size changed between the 11 and the 12 and the 13, did it?
I think it's minimal. Yeah, no, it is because I had to buy a new case for this phone. I had to buy a case because I already went during the last.
The 11 was the same size as the 10, which was the funky size that nothing else ever was again. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because it shows. I mean, if on the site that compares the page where you compare all the devices on the same page, where did that go?
Okay, the 12 Pro is 5.78. So 6.1 is definitely bigger. Huh, why did they do that? I don't really want that extra.
Yeah, because the 13, I guess the 13 Max was, what was it called before?
13 Max was 6.33, or 12 Max, rather. Yeah, probably 13 was 6.
Yeah, because it says here 6.1 and 6.7, so I guess...
Wait. Okay, hold on.
Hold on.
5.78, looking at a different article, 5.78 tall, but it is 6.1 diagonal.
Yeah, no, it's all measured diagonally, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So this is the same size. This is no bigger. Okay. The 12 Pro was 6.1 diagonal.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So it's the same size.
So it's the same size.
Yeah, it's because I was wondering I'm just using a ruler here, old school, and yeah, it's 6 inches, so yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it's not a different, like I don't have to get a different case and things like that. And
right.
Different adapters and reprint my MagSafe folder and all that stuff. Okay, cool. Good to know. All right. So that is the name of that tune. So I think 3 iPhone 14 Pros on order coming from our world, end of the world, whether we do it on day 1 or day 37.
Yeah.
Some point in the future, we'll be buying phones. Cool. All right. So moving on, are we done with the event? Are we safe to move on?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So Paul Hudson and his, you know, Infinite Glory has produced the article, What's New in Swift 5.7, which is interesting. It's funny, you know, Tammy and I interviewed Paul years ago, and one of the questions we asked him was, do you not sleep at night? Like, how do you, I mean, admittedly, this information has been not out available for a while anyway, but he always seems to go away, you know, come back with these amazing articles within a day or so of a release. And so we were asking him about that, and he was telling us about this exercise that he had when he was learning, when he was a magazine writer. And the one of the creative writing exercises he had was he was given the task of writing a review of 8 bottles of water, right, in 200 words, which is like infinitesimally small amount of writing to do, like especially for someone who was at the time writing about Unix and all that kind of stuff, right? And at the end, the reality is these are 8 bottles of water, like Evian water and Dasani water and a bunch of other, you know, smart waters and all that. But at the end of the day, it's all just water, right? And so he struggled with how to pare all this information down into this short little article that you could basically, the exercise was to simplify and refine the article down to the point where you could get it out quickly and also be very succinct in what you were saying. And so he was looking around trying to figure out how he was struggling to get this amount of brevity into his writing. And he looked over to one of the games writers and saw that the guy had, you know, was able to do this. And he said, well, how did you do this? He says, well, first thing I do is I throw out 5 of the balls of water. They're not worth talking about, you know, kind of thing. And then take the top 3, write up, you know, 25 words on the top, on the second and third place. And on the one that's the number one water I've chosen, I write 100 words on it, right? And that basically fills out the article and gets the article done in time. So interestingly, if you think about it now, he takes all this information that we're all getting thrown at us through a fire hose, takes out the top, you know, let's say 10 things that are really interesting. And that's how he produces these articles so quickly. So it's kind of cool when you think about it that way. That said, I did go through some of this article. I don't know if you guys have gone through it, but we talked about the new if-let syntax. I think the last time we talked about on the show about, you know, you have to, if you're just going to use the name of the passed in variable, you don't have to create a new, you don't have to reference it again kind of thing. You guys remember talking about that, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And then the other thing is the closure. Oh wait, I forget this one. Type inference on multi statements. If they're the same, you don't have to worry about calling those out. Do you guys look at any of these other things stick out as super interesting to you? Okay, here we go. I don't know. You can talk about regex or you can talk about regex. Either way is fine. But the new stuff that Apple, they talked about.
But why would you say regex? Because that's wrong.
GIF, Mark.
Yeah, GIF is correct. Regex is correct.
We talked about this on a previous podcast. I'll put a link back to that episode where we talked about regex versus regex. No matter how you pronounce it, Apple has, or Swift, the folks at Swift.org have made it easier to deal with now, because now we have regular expression, easier ways of dealing with regular expressions using, you know, commonly used terminology, or you can actually use regular expression syntax to find things in your content, your strings and what have you. A couple of really good examples on that. Any other of these things that these top tens that he's picked out here that stick out in your mind?
Don't think so. The concurrency one, are you talking about the unavailable from async attribute?
Or the concurrency and top level code?
Yeah, that one. Yeah.
It's allowing you to use a Swift concurrency outside of a class or a struct.
Right. Right.
Which apparently you couldn't do that before. I didn't even know you couldn't do that before, but apparently you couldn't do that before. Now you can.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. That was a hassle. Similarly, in the Node.js world, you do a lot of async await type stuff. And curiously, mm-hmm. like the top level, main structure didn't have that available to it until, you know, some version of Node.js that came out. So I can understand where this is coming from, that it was a little silly that you couldn't run it from main.swift. Not that you would run a lot of stuff, but if you
wanted to just
run something it's like, oh, you want to use async await? Nope, can't happen. Because reasons, right? And it says here that this is one of those things that might seem trivial on the surface, but took a lot of work to make happen, which is understandable. But now you no longer have to do the workaround of the at main struct with an asynchronous main method. So now you can just get to what you wanted to do. It was that.
I guess it's because main is just, it's a synchronous function, right? And mm-hmm. it's just like in regular Swift concurrency, you can't just call an async thing. You have to put it in the task or something like that because the synchronous function just needs to keep going. So you need to give it a way to keep going. And I guess for some reason here, again, it's not clear why you couldn't just do that same kind of thing. But like I said, apparently you couldn't, and now you can. So great.
Yeah, I think it's one of those carrying back of programming languages. I've seen something similar in Java and C#, where Java and C# being heavily object oriented in their design, like full on didn't want to let you run something outside of a main method from a class. Like even the most trivial, like, you know, I'm just starting to learn how to program thing would require you to do that. And eventually people said, you know, I just want to run some code, man. I just want to like write this quick script to do something. Why do I have to go through all of this you know, ceremony. And so you've seen, and each of these languages has a different way of calling it. It's like simplified API or basis. I don't know, but it's basically like, let me just write some code. You know what I was trying to do. I'll add in the extra ceremony when I really need it, not just to get started on it. Kind of as a nice compromise where things like, you know, Python just like lets you start writing right away. Ruby lets you start writing right away. They don't have that same structure. I think that's what this is part of. You start out with particular design principles for how you're doing things, and then as you get experience from the field, people are like, yeah, it'd be kind of nice to not have to do this like boilerplate thing. Just so I can run this full, I mean, here in this example, what is he? Is he just getting some JSON from a URL session and decoding it? Like, that looks simple and easy, and I would have guessed that that would have worked prior to this change, and I'm glad that this change exists now for that. So I would have been very grumpy of like, oh god, okay, well, let me go do my main string, I think it is main. Okay, just let me get to what I want to do. I want to write code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other one that came out too was the clock instant and duration ways of measuring time or referring to time in Swift and durations in Swift. You can now have, time can actually be like, you can have a clock that can run when the system is in the background or not. As well, you can, instances is a way of measuring an exact moment in time and, or representing an exact, and durations is you can set a certain amount of time and you can have tolerance to be plus the time. So it can be like, if you want to measure something that happens in a second, you can expect it to happen in a second or a second and a half, or no less than a second. But yeah, that's kind of a interesting thing. And you know, since I made Pi Day countdown timers of something that I'm almost thinking about. Anything else on this that stands out?
There's some nice new things they've done with opaque parameters.
Yeah,
it's actually nothing new, but they've made the syntax a lot nicer. So instead of having to you know, explicitly put in a generic and so an opaque is, you know, you want to just like say compare two things that are both conform to the same protocol and they're the same type, right? But you don't care what type they are. Mm-hmm. Well, the old way you had to do it was you had to have a generic that conformed to the protocol and then pass in you know, say an array of that generic in order to compare the items or sort the items in the array or something like that. Now you can just pass in an array of some comparable, let's say. I'm using his example here. That's why I'm talking about sorting and arrays. It just cleans up the syntax a lot. You don't have to go through all of the generic boilerplate to do what's fundamentally a simple thing. You really just want to pass an array of stuff by protocol instead of by type. And now you can do that.
Yeah, that's kind of nice because from what I remember on the sum stuff, it was saying like, I'm not going to define it here, but I 100% trust you, compiler, to realize that like you can still do all the checks. Just don't force the ceremony here. That's pushed elsewhere, if I remember correctly. So this does seem like it would be, I mean, just comparing it to the generic stuff where he says that this is syntactic sugar for the equivalent generic code. It's kind of a lot nicer to have it be cleaner there.
Really what it's doing is enforcing the sum is enforcing that all of the type members of that protocol are the same concrete type in this situation. So if you just have something like, you know, array of protocol, then anything that conforms to that protocol could be in that array. Mm-hmm. And so you can't like do you can't do operations on all the members of that array because they're different concrete types. But if you just stick that sum protocol in there, then you don't know what concrete type they are, but you do know that they're all the same concrete type. So you can do operations on all of them, the same operation on all of them.
Right, because you've made a guarantee. Nice. You've made a guarantee about the consistency of that. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, which is exactly what the generic was doing, but it's in a much cleaner way. So it's pretty nice.
All right. Yeah, lots more reading to do there. So yeah, check that article out for sure. And then we'll move to our picks. I got a few picks piling up here since we've been off the air for a bit. First one, this is a follow-up from the WWDC lounges that were happening on the Slack channels. This gentleman here has archived the Swift UI Lounge, available on his GitHub, I believe. I guess his website. So yeah, if you want to just go check that out, I'll have a link in the show notes for that. Command option R, I don't know if we've ever talked about this one before, but this is one of my favorite commands. If I have recently done a build to a simulator or to a device, and I want to test some more code, but I don't want to necessarily go through the whole process of doing a build again, normally command R will kick off a build. Command option R will just open up the app and run it, or open up the simulator and run it without doing a build, which is kind of a really handy.
Yeah, this one is awesome. I use this one all the time. Yeah,
same here. And then command shift J, I can't remember why we talked about this one before, but this is another one of my favorite Xcode shortcuts. When you're looking for something and you're searching around, maybe using a finder, a filter, you find the code you're in, you put your cursor in the middle of the standard editor, and you're like, where in the project navigator does this file exist? Hit command shift J and it will show you in the project navigator where that file is living in. So it's kind of
by the way, that was my pick, Tim, that you just stole.
Oh, that was your pick?
Yep. Okay. That's okay.
Well, you didn't put your name on it, so
yeah, I know.
I would
did you also want to do it like care. A pick?
Carry on.
All right, carrying on, all right. But we've talked about Command Shift J 1,000 times on this show, because that's another one. I think Jack Wu way back in the day wrote an article on Xcode tips, and that was one of the finds for sure.
So you've paired it with jump to definition. I would say it also pairs pretty nicely with Command Shift O for the quick find. So yep. You're like, I know there's like a FizzBuzz protocol. Let me go edit that. Oh wait, where is this thing actually located? Because there's probably something else I need to change too. And the Command Shift J works pretty well. If like I searched to get here, I have no clue where I am in the project. But pretty nice for that too.
Right. Cool. The other one. Again, this may be a repeat pick from before. Swift version. I think there might be a few sites around that do this, but James Dempsey of James Dempsey and the Breakpoints. He mentioned this in the end of his talk last week at 360 iDev. Runs this domain called SwiftVersion.net, and this is a super handy tool to check and see which version of Xcode runs which version of Swift, which is super handy if you're working with multiple versions of Swift and you're not sure what is what. So he obviously needs to update this through the RCs, because Swift 5.7 went out with the release candidates today. And we've talked about a similar site to this one. I think Greg sent us a link to something way back in the day. And then generally speaking, my Steve Lipton is one of the drummers from the James Dempsey and the Breakpoints. He's out of the Chicago area. I had started working on this particular course that he put up on LinkedIn Learning, which I now have access to. I've had it through the Toronto Library, but I now have it through work as well. Swift UI Essential Training, which is kind of an interesting take on learning all things Swift UI. It's a fairly recent course. And what I really like about his approach to this particular teaching is that not only does he show you how to, you know, edit the code and work with modifiers inside of the standard editor, but also on the canvas, he shows you how to drag things out of the library, put them into the canvas, and you know, there's like little bars that sort of show up as to whether it's below or beside or inside kind of thing. And as you do that, it actually updates the code on the screen. So you can sort of place things on the view in Swift UI where you want them to be, and then it'll add it to the appropriate place in the code, rather than trying to guess where do I put the padding and the spacer and the, when you're doing the standard editor stuff, and sort of a hit and miss thing. So that's kind of cool. But also, Steve Lipton also has a number of courses on Playgrounds, which I found rather interesting. He gave us access to a beta he's working on, which is going to be available on his Patreon page, and I'll put a link to that. But it is using the Swift Playground app to create apps for distribution to the App Store. Like, not only just how to make an app in using just the iPad or Swift Playgrounds on your Mac, but going through the whole process, including setting up an application in Apple Connect and uploading it from the Swift Playground as well, which is kind of cool. So that's a neat course that he's got coming soon, and like I said, I had a sneak peek of it. And I also went back to his course from a couple of years ago on all things Swift Playground, which includes, you know, creating apps, working with Playground books, and as well as working with Markdown in Playgrounds, which is kind of interesting. And he shows you how to do this back and forth between Xcode and the iPad itself. And then I'm going to throw it over to Jaime, because I'm not going to steal his pick, although very tempted to do so, but no, I'll let him do it.
Yeah, this one is neil.fun/design-the-next-iPhone, with hyphens in there, by Neil Agarwal. And so if you were dissatisfied with today's Apple event, you can decide that, you know what, this phone really needs a cup holder. It needs an old school antenna, so that you don't have to worry about pointing at the no fancy pants satellite. You can put, you know, handlebars, cup holders, and if you enjoyed Michelle Yeoh's Everything Everywhere All at Once, you might put some googly eyes on it as well. There are many absurd options here. It's kind of fun, and it has even a little present option that gives you a little cinematic that cut.
Yeah, you can add like a pro stand, pro display, rotary dial. I put pro wheels on my design when I made one a couple of weeks ago. It doesn't seem to work in Safari. Is it working for, or maybe on Intel it's not working? It worked fine on the M1 Mac.
It worked for you, honey? I'm a Chrome user, so I did not even know that there was something weird.
Oh, you're on Chrome.
I'm a Chrome user. Chrome. Yeah.
I'm using it on Safari on an M1, and it works fine.
Yeah, I'm on the Intel right now because that's where I record the show. But yeah, no, I did play around with this last week when I first saw it. So I don't know if I saw it as your pick, but I think I saw somebody post it online.
Yeah, this made the rounds.
Three pro wheels. Yeah, three pro wheels. I put a rotary dial on it and a pro camera as well on the back.
I got the cup holder in there.
Did you?
Yeah.
Hmm. Nice.
You put an Android logo on the back to prevent people from stealing it because it signals hot garbage.
Because it's 100 degrees out here, so you gotta stay hydrated. So you need that cup holder.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah,
exactly.
Well, speaking of Android, did you see that Apple? I think they finally got 50% of the market, at least, or more than 50% of the market in the US last week.
Pretty interesting because they've been pretty close on the seeing it. They overtook, right? It was like a 51 or 50.1 split.
Yeah. They could have a referendum now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a bad Canadian political joke. 50% plus one was what the vote needed to be to separate Quebec from Canada.
Ah,
but yeah. That's kind of what Apple has done in this market. Cool. Right, well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, where do they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @devwiththehair.
All right, and Mark, if people can get in touch with you?
I think this email is still valid. markr@smapsoft.com.
Maybe you should give them the Earthlink one while you're at it.
Yeah, right.
All right. My name is Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, on the Twitter machine as well. You'll find me. And so until next time, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fireside.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends, leave a comment on the website, or write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC, and we may mention you on the show. Friends of the show can also join us on the podcast Slack channel. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Every dollar pledged helps a lot. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Right. So I bought all kinds of Guinness paraphernalia when I was in Ireland as well.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. All right. If we're going to do after show, I got to get some water. Hold on a second. I'll be right back.
Okay, sure.
So I'm wondering if the Guinness store is like a like a Harley Davidson store where they just have all manner of stuff that has the logo on it.
But you know, it's funny that you say that, because what we went, like, on the first part of the trip, we went to the Guinness store and you know, got to sample Guinness and try it and see how they make it and all that kind of stuff. And then they have this huge store at the bottom where you're like, I have never seen this many t-shirts before, like rugby shirts and golf shirts and, you know, all kinds of t-shirts in English and in Gaelic and, you know, for the men, for the women, for the kiddos, hats, you know, mugs, toques for the keeping your head warm, socks, Christmas decorations, keychains, you know, all kinds of paraphernalia having related with the Guinness logo on it. And then you leave Dublin and you go to like another major city and like Cork, or you go to, you know, down further south, and they have these small stores. I think it's called, these are the Q now, I can't remember, Quinty, I think, or something like that. But they also are a licensed Guinness store. And I found more things at the non-Guinness place, like the, I forgot the name of the place now, but the main brewery place in the touristy brewery place in Dublin. I found more paraphernalia, like hat pins and lapel pins and stuff like that, at other places, other stores. So it's anywhere you go in Ireland, there's an officially licensed, you know, reseller of all this stuff, right? But again, it is still way more than you'll see anywhere like in Canada or US, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's really cool to see all the old, like they had a whole exhibit of all the old advertisements that they've done over the years. And then you drive around the country and you see bars decorated on the outside with these old retro designs from like, you know, the 50s and 60s and 70s, right? So yeah, I think I took a picture of one place where it said Guinness is good for you, right on the tin, right? That must be true, right? Thanks, we lost Mark.
He went to go get water. So.
Ah, real time follow up. St. James Gate is the place where Guinness is produced in Ireland, in Dublin.
I see.
I'm back.
And he's back.
The coolest thing is the Guinness really better in Ireland than it is here in,
you know,
North America?
Yeah, I'm going to get probably a lot of email about this, but I drink Guinness a lot, right? I drink it all the time. Draft Guinness at a bar is much better than the Guinness you get in the cans,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, but I gotta say, you know, as much as I'm supposed to say that it was amazing in Ireland, I wouldn't say it was that much better than we experience here, to be honest with you. Like, I don't know, I think maybe it's just the way that they produce it and they deliver it around the world. It's just as good coming out of a keg with nitrogen in California as it is in Dublin, right? I know that's probably blasphemous to say, but.
Well, you know, I'm not surprised. I mean, with, you know, modern refrigeration and fast transport, it's very different than, you know, a long time ago when it was on a boat for 3 weeks in the heat, right?
Yeah, yeah. But we have a Labatt's brewery here. We have Molson and Labatt's, so the two main brewers in Canada, like the sort of top dogs, right? And the Labatt's brewery is licensed to produce, I'm doing air quotes here, Guinness, right? Mm-hmm. It's not produced with nitrogen, so it doesn't have that nice foamy sort of sensation to it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just, yeah, it's just not, it's not pleasant, you know. As it's a stout, admittedly, and it is produced, I guess, with a recipe that, you know, I think the malt is cooked in the same way that it is in Ireland, but yeah, it doesn't even hold a candle to it. So, I mean, from that perspective, yeah, you could say that the Guinness you get from a tap, from a keg made in Dublin, is much better than this bottle swill that they sell as Guinness. So I'll have to go maybe buy a bottle of it and just try to see it. Because, I mean, well, I had it once.
The bottled stuff is actually even a different recipe than what's in the can.
No, but what I'm saying, like, now you get the nitrogen widget in the bottles from Guinness, like, you know, the ones with the black label with the gold harp on it, right? No, this is a different Guinness. Like it comes in a bottle, doesn't just regular carbonated, you know, beverage,
right,
kind of thing,
right?
Right, and it's nowhere near what you think of as Guinness. And I could see that being, if that was the Guinness we had here in Canada back in the 50s and 60s, like, yeah, definitely the Guinness you were getting in Ireland was like light years better, right? So, but I think but compared to like 2020 and 2022 beer that you get here at a bar versus what you got in even in St. James Gate, I don't know it was that much better, you know? Mm-hmm. Mind you, I don't get it to the pubs much these days anyway, so it's because of the whole COVID nonsense, right? But yeah. We did drink a lot of Guinness in Ireland, that's for sure.
Good. How about Murphy's? Did you have any Murphy's?
I tried Murphy's, and there's another one they've got called Island IPA, I think they call it, which is another brewer's make, and it might even be made by the same folks at Guinness. But one place I went to, they gave me a flight of three different, like a third of a pint of the three different ones. And to be honest with you, if I had my eyes closed, I probably couldn't tell you which was which. Like they were very, like Murphy's is very close to Guinness.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, my son swears that it's different. I don't think it is.
It is different, but it's very similar.
Yeah, it's very, 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 and we have a beer here called Cobblestone by Mill Street Brewery, which is, again, it's another nitro beer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it has the nitro gives it the same sort of consistency. Mm-hmm. The flavoring is a little different than Guinness, but yeah, it's very, you know, if you couldn't get a Guinness and you could get a Cobblestone, you'd have a smile on your face, you know, if you were looking for something like that. So I think
Island IPA.
I think it's called Island IPA. It's a new one from in Ireland. But yeah, it was everywhere, but very similar to this, right? I also did a flight of Jameson as well, which is really interesting.
Jameson whiskey?
Yeah, whiskey. Yeah.
A flight? That's dangerous.
Yeah, like distillations, I guess you call it. Mm-hmm. One was like an IPA, believe it or not. I don't know why it was called IPA, but because it wasn't hoppy or anything like that, and they tasted very similar, but you know, the three were very different, and I forget now which one was which, the one I liked the most. But yeah, that was a very interesting way to drink. But the most amazing thing I saw in Ireland, I think, was on the very first day that Carol and I had an outing, we went up to north of Dublin to a place called I'm gonna get my Instagram out here so I can remember the name of it. Knoth is Knoth is one place, and what was the other one called? Or Knouth, I guess. And it's a pretty famous place when you go to. We saw lots of stone circles too. Oh, here it is. This one here. Newgrange. Newgrange is sort of the branded name that you know of. You will have heard of before, but. These are ceremonial burial places that were put together by engineers 5,000 years ago, like so 3,000 years before the pyramids. And they're amazing, amazing structures. And what was cool about the one at Newgrange was you go into it, you're not allowed to take pictures inside, but you go into this thing and you go inside the tomb, and it's really thin and narrow, and you have to bend over because you bang your head as you're going through. Wouldn't be a problem for Jaime, of course, but you get in there and you're in the middle of this sort of dome that was built, you know, that many years ago, and it's all done by you know what cobbling, I think, coffering, where they layer the wide stones over top of each other in a sort of like pattern, almost like the inside of an igloo. Basically, this roof was built, this dome basically made of stone was built 5,000 years ago and is completely waterproof. It has never crumbled or leaked or whatever in 5,000 years. It's an amazing structure to be inside and sort of just take in. And plus all the scrapings and carvings that the artists of the day would have done into the stone, right? Yeah, those were amazing, amazing structures to be inside, especially, you know, Neolithic. You know, architecture, if you will, right? It's really kind of cool stuff. That was probably the most amazing stuff that I personally went to.
By the way, was it Island's Edge they had in Ireland?
Yeah, that might be Island's Edge. Yeah.
Okay, that's actually made by Heineken in Ireland.
Is it? Oh, yeah, really?
But it's a stout. It's a stout. It's not an IPA, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not an IPA. Yeah, no, it's yeah. Island's Edge. Yeah. It was everywhere. And like, it tasted like, it's a nitro beer, right? Nitrogen beer.
Yeah.
And it tasted just like Guinness or Murphy's. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very, very
yeah, it looks comparable. Like it. But yeah, it's made by Heineken Ireland. That's funny.
Really? Is Heineken's German, right?
Dutch.
Dutch, okay, because they were everywhere. Like, everywhere you went, you saw Heineken as well, right? Heineken or Guinness or Murphy's.
Yeah. I think they're Dutch. Hold on.
Yeah, Wikipedia says they're Dutch.
Yeah, in Dublin, there wasn't much Murphy's to be had, but if you went outside of Dublin, there was lots of Murphy's around. Hmm. I think Cork is, Murphy's is in Cork, maybe? I think that was kind of like, you don't drink Guinness in Cork. One of those two places. But if you head over to my Instagram, you can see all the pictures of stuff that I saw when I was there. Lots of old churches. And some of our family kissed the Blarney Stone, but I was thinking with COVID protocols and stuff, I don't want to be like slathering my, not that I would do that anyway, because I think it's kind of a silly hanging over the edge of a rock face upside down.
Well, and you know, supposedly all the locals think it's such a joke that everyone comes and and you know what they do on the Blarney Stone when no one's looking?
Go pee on it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course
you do. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they had security cameras there, so I'm sure they're kind of curtailing that activity. Yeah. But Blarney basically means nothing. It's like it's a nothing castle. It's just a castle that happens to be there. It has no significance other than the fact that it's got this stone, right? Like if you read the tourist guides on it, it's like, you know, it's not like even a significant castle, right? It was given the name Blarney by, I think, Queen Victoria. But also the Neolithic stone circles were kind of cool, like these amazing, you know, almost like mini Stonehenge kind of, Stonehenge is compared to them, right? But these old, you know, Neolithic and dolmens and things like that, kind of interesting, when you consider the fact that they did all that before the Age of Iron, right?
Mm-hmm.
With this manpower and chutzpah.
So apparently this Island's Edge has only been out for like a year. It's very new.
Yeah. Yeah. But the brand, you wouldn't know that from the branding, and it's all over the place, right?
Mm. So mm-hmm.
It was a decent beer. I did try one. Lots of fun.
That is a quick.
Oh, you got to figure if they're going to go up against Guinness in Ireland, they better be pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah,
that was a quick.
Driving on the correct side of the road was a challenge too.
Sorry, I was wondering like how long does it take to get from Tirana to Dublin, and it's a 6.5 hour flight. Like a trip around the block.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little further than California, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. And you were saying that you had trouble driving on the other side of the road?
Well, yeah. I mean, that was a challenge. I ended up getting an automatic car, and I'm glad I did because, even though one of my family members swears that, you know, driving a standard was probably, in their mind, easier. I ended up putting my little hack you saw on Twitter. I put a piece of tape on the dashboard to sort of get my bearings, you know, cause I kept my wife was sitting in the passenger seat and she just kept saying, move over. Like she kept thinking I was going to clip the cars as it's going along. Cause my natural inclination is to move to the left. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you go. And it was really weird. Like every time you saw a car coming towards you around a corner, right. You're like, oh my God, he's on the wrong side. Oh wait, never mind. You know, like you have this momentary, you know, heart in your throat kind of feeling, right? So, and then, you know, when you're making a right-hand turn, you have to remember to drive into the further lane. So you're sort of talking to yourself as you're driving the whole time, like, you know, and then I had to have always, you know, I drove a few times by myself, but most of the time I had somebody sitting in the passenger seat, sort of, you know, being my conscience, right? My Jiminy Cricket, right? So, yeah, that was a challenge.
Yeah,
I wasn't looking forward to it, and I'm glad it's over.
Yeah, it probably is also weird as a pedestrian having to look the opposite direction when you're crossing the street too.
Oh right? Yeah, that was weird too.
Yeah.
The other thing too is like driving to these remote stone circles and stuff like that. As you're driving, the roads are to begin with are not very wide to begin with, and as you're driving towards the far out, you know, rural places. Roads get narrower and narrower and narrower, and it's huge thistles on both sides of the road. So you it's like these woods. You cannot go off the road. And the weirdest thing was when you come up to somebody else is coming the other way, and you kind of look at each other, and one of you has to like shove the car into the bush on the side as far as you can. And again, you know, it's all heavy timber, so you can't really go too far. And then they would just squeak by you on the other side. So yeah, it was kind of a interesting etiquette. And the whole driving on roundabouts thing was took me a while to get used to that. Like, whoever's in the roundabout has the right of way, right? So it's kind of, as you're coming into a roundabout, you kind of stop and you look and you have to sort of guess which guy, because you never know which of the four corners that guy's going to peel out on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I got beeped at a few times when I kind of went into the roundabout too early, you know? And plus it was a backward roundabout too, right? You know, you guys probably have roundabouts in the States you've driven on, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Everything's backwards.
Yeah.
And then it got to the point where people would say to me, turn right, and I would turn left because my brain was just upside down. I was like in the stranger, you know, the Stranger Things kind of upside down world, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Poor Guinness out for the people behind you. Like, come on, get on with it. Wondering what's going on, not knowing that there's somebody who...
Incredibly friendly country. I mean, like, from that point of view, like everybody says hello to you on the street and stuff like that. But the funny thing is, like, it took us a while to figure out. So if you see a car with an L on it, right, that's someone who has a learner's permit. They have this big sticker on the back of the car. And then they have N for people who are novices who've, you know, they've gotten past, they've done the first test, they've passed. And now they've got like a year or two of driving with a big N on the back of the car. They totally need a T for tourists.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I felt like just putting an L on the, back of the car just to give people a hint, right? Stay back.
Never
know what I'm going to do next. Right.
Did people let you know that when they say top of the morning to you, that the proper response is and the rest of the day to you?
No, nobody ever said that to me, Hemi.
Oh. Ruined vacation.
No, it's funny. It's funny because you know when ambient noise is kind of an interesting thing. And when you listen to people talk, like in Dublin, you wouldn't know that you're in a different country, other than, you know, occasionally you hear a bit of a lilt or a pronunciation kind of thing. But the further you move away from Dublin, the thicker the accents get, and it's quite different. One of Carol's cousins came and was talking to us about driving up to Northern Ireland, where it's a different attitude. Like, you really have to be careful about, if your car breaks down, you have to automatically assume a Northern Ireland accent. And so he did that a few times. Like, he showed us, you know, what he would say. And all of a sudden, like, he gets the sort of, you know, Bob Geldof kind of, brogue going, right? It wasn't like that noticeable, in the parts of Ireland. We were in the south and west, but wasn't that really noticeable in Dublin, that, you know, that you were in a different country, really? Other than the fact they were driving on the wrong side of the road.
Yeah, it's
interesting.
Probably a weird one for Commonwealthers such as Canadians, where you're in between two worlds, in that part of the world and your neighbor to the south, where we influence a lot. So. I don't even know how to do it.
Ireland's not in the Commonwealth.
No, but like, there's that close relationship there, right? That, like, true, not part of the United Kingdom, not part of Great Britain, but, you know, that close relationship that's there, you know, in that region, and then Canada's very close relationship to that region, whereas the US is, we're a little further away, right? We got our own thing going on. And so for the Canadians to be like, okay, you know, driving the opposite of the road, but you do understand kilometers. You do have a whole metric thing. Yeah. So you live. Although I know like England uses like a lot of, you know, still is this imperial system for like a lot of weird things. What is it like over there in Ireland, being not England? Do they have kilometers everywhere? Do they maintain any?
Yeah, they're very close to Canada in that sense. Mm-hmm. You're right there. I mean, like, yeah, they don't life. Like, I think in England they still drive in, or think of driving miles, and I think there's one other thing. I don't know if it's measurement, but it's either weight or measurements where they're like still using imperial, right?
I see.
But yeah, no, Ireland's very, very close to Canada in that sense, that they're metric and they're, you know, everything else is like normal. The only thing is that they have different passport and different money, right?
Yeah.
In England.
Yeah. And so just interesting, funny little berries. Like you said, toque much earlier without specifying that is a beanie here.
Yeah.
Translating to the Americans.
No, they wouldn't know what toque is in Ireland either, because it's obviously a Canadian term.
that a French Canadian term? I can't recall if that's.
It may have French Canadian roots. Yeah, but yeah, toque is definitely it's what we call a I don't know what do you call it, head warmer beanie. I thought a beanie was like a baseball hat without a brim.
So that is fair. So you're thinking of like the kind with the propeller on it that like the new yeah, Googlers
yeah,
wear.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah, yeah, Nooglers. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. That's fair.
That's not a beanie.
I believe that is also a beanie, but I guess wherever it turned into the wool and knit hat, cap.
What you're talking about?
I think wool knit wool cap is probably yeah. what it would be, and then somebody started calling it a beanie for reasons, I suppose, and since. Hardly anyone has a Howdy Doody style, you know, traditional beanie. It seems like the old word has the old meaning been lost.
Mm-hmm. No idea.
Well, that's cool. That's cool that you had a good trip there. Don't know when I'll make my way to that part of the world again, but you know what is weirdly on my list now is Wrexham.
Have you been to Ireland before?
I've not been to Ireland, no.
Oh, okay.
But I have, you know, I mean, everything is so close. By comparison to, again, folks, go check out the true size of, like, America and Canada are enormous in terms of landmass size. So when I looked at Google Maps for one of these things, I was like, oh, that looks far. I was like, oh, it's not far at all. So I've been watching Welcome to Wrexham, the FX and Hulu show about Wrexham Football Club over in Wales, where they got purchased by...
That's the Ryan Reynolds one?
Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. From It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Yeah. So they bought the team. I was like, where is Wrexham? I'm like, oh, okay. Like a couple hours from Aberystwyth in Wales. Mm-hmm. It is probably most plausible as an hour drive from Manchester, which is a pretty easy airport to get to. So it might be on the list if I go back to that general region. Again, I'm being very hand wavy and painting it all as one region because it's like, you know, again, I looked at Google Maps. It's like, oh man, it's going to be like a 5 hour. Oh, it's a 1 hour drive. It's pretty close. Pretty easy. Getting across, zipping across the country. Pretty easy when you've got something that size.
Hmm.
I think Edinburgh or Glasgow to London is like Boston to New York or something, or like Boston to Philly or something. Like the scale that we're talking about is wild.
Hmm.
But yeah, I do recommend that show. It's kind of like watching a real life Ted Lasso.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, he's the guy from that Apple TV show, right? McElhenney?
Yeah, Mythic Quest. He's on that show as well.
Mythic Quest, yeah. Yeah. Please, Ian. Yeah.
That's right. Ian the is he like art director? What was his title? His
designer? He's the head game creator. Yeah.
Wait, wasn't he also in
It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia? Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
That's what Harmony started with, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a good gig because, you know, the show is not only kind of an interesting insight from a, like, documentary kind of standpoint, but it's also kind of funny to see, like, oh, there's, you know, Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia wearing the Wrexham shirt because, of course, why not cross-promote?
Yeah.
Oh, there's Aviation Gin and whatever it is, that mobile service that Ryan Reynolds owns. I'm like, yeah, of course. If I owned a team, I would also make sure that they use all my other stuff too and get some cross promotion for that same money.
But he was wearing it on the show.
Besides that, there's a lot of different workout outfits that a professional team might wear when it's not actually playing, like trainers kind of stuff. And some hoodie that they have is Aviation Gin. Don't know if I saw the mobile service. Might not make as much sense because it presumably is not outside of North America, but still kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it is stupid expensive to run a team. Like in one of the episodes, they have a problem with the pitch, and that was something they'd already spent a lot of money on, and they had to spend like double the money to fix it when they realized there was a problem. It kind of feels like, man, who was it? I think it might have been Richard Branson from Virgin that said, like, how do you become a millionaire? You start as a billionaire, then you buy an airline, I think is what he said. And so you become a millionaire by starting as a billionaire and then buying an airline. It's kind of your path to losing money.
Right. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, folks, I think we'll call it.
Alrighty.
Alrighty.
What do you say?
Sounds good.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.